I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the final afternoon in the London Review Bookshop's World Literature Weekend. This afternoon, we have the great privilege of listening to Yekaterina Korotkova-Grossman in conversation with Robert Chandler about the work of her father, the Russian novelist Vasily Grossman. At the moment, I'm reading the recently reissued autobiography of the Hungarian poet George Feludy, My Happy Days in Hell, in which he comments at one point that the Second World War produced no great literature. When Feludy wrote this in the 1960s, he was, of course, unaware of the existence of Vasily Grossman's life and fate. Not just the finest novel inspired by the war, but arguably one of the greatest novels ever written. As John Lanchester wrote in the London Review of Books a couple of years ago, War and Peace hangs over Grossman's book as a template and a lodestar. And the measure of Grossman's great achievement is that a comparison between the two books is not inappropriate. Grossman was born in the Ukraine in 1905 and died in 1964, unknown outside Soviet Russia and largely suppressed within it. The manuscripts of Life and Fate had been confiscated by the KGB, and Grossman had been informed that there would not be an edition of the book for 200 years. Grossman described the suppression of Life and Fate as a kind of death. It was, he said, as though he had been strangled in a dark corner. But even after a microfilm text of Life and Fate had been smuggled to the West, it took almost 5 years for the first Russian edition to appear there. Robert Chandler suggests that this was partly due to anti-Semitism among Russian émigrés. The high and ever-growing reputation Grossman now has in the West is not in small part due to Robert Chandler, his translator. Robert translated the first English language version of Life and Fate in the mid-1980s, and it has been reissued recently to renewed acclaim. Robert is also the translator of Grossman's last unfinished novel, Everything Flows, which has just been published, and of a collection of Grossman's stories. The debt we owe to Robert for bringing Grossman to English-speaking readers was acknowledged in The Guardian on 18th of May this year, when that paper devoted a leader article to Grossman entitled In Praise of Vasily Grossman. I quote, part of the reason for Grossman's resurgence today is that he has at last found a translator in Robert Chandler worthy of him, one who has the rare gift of conveying the unexpected twists of the original Russian text. Radio 4 will be broadcasting an 8-hour dramatization of Life and Fate next year. This afternoon, Robert Chandler will be talking to Vasily Grossman's daughter, Yekaterina Korotkova-Grossman, about her father's life and work, and about her own memoir, Ukraine on the Edge of Empire, which describes the years in Lvov immediately after the Second World War. We are absolutely delighted and greatly honored that she has come to be with us this afternoon, and we welcome her with gratitude. Thank you.
It is a great honor to be here with Yekaterina Vasilievna. I want to introduce her at some length, and then I hope sort of gradually disappear from the conversation. But she's worked in quite a number of different fields, as a teacher, as a school teacher, but also as a translator of English literature. And it was a great and rather unexpected joy to me that after meeting her in Moscow last autumn, I was able to give her the American edition, the NYRB Classics edition of Everything Flows. And she read it very, very attentively and made a lot of extremely helpful comments, some on points of fact, but also some very fine stylistic points, which we were able to incorporate into this, twice more revised translation published by Harville Secker. So I have experienced firsthand her own sensitivity to literature. I don't know a great deal about the English literature that she has translated. I know that she has translated articles and letters by Dickens. I want to just quote one little passage from one of her memoirs, because this says something both about her and about her father. When she was working as a translator, she was regularly visiting some older Russian women who were also translators of English literature. And one of them had been critical of the Pickwick Club. And Grossman himself was very indignant about any criticism of Dickens, but particularly of this book. And he referred to these old witches criticizing Dickens. Pickwick is it's a work of genius, it's a miracle. The writer managed to portray a fat, absurd, not in any way heroic person, someone with a lot of comic everyday traits, and make him into someone great merely by showing one thing, the charm of goodness, or the charm of kindness, abayanya dobrote. And Yekaterina Vasilievna goes on to say that Grossman, during his last years, valued kindness, or goodness, good-naturedness, more than anything, more than intelligence. That's quite an important point about Grossman. He is always going to be associated to a considerable degree with a number of the most terrible pages of 20th century history, the Battle of Stalingrad, Treblinka, and so on. But I really do not think he was in any way a writer who was kind of fascinated by violence. I think he was more fascinated by love and kindness. These terrible themes were forced on him by the events that his life threw him up against. Yekaterina Vasilievna is also a writer herself. She's written historical fiction, some of it set in the time of Peter the Great. There's only one fairly brief piece of hers which has been translated into English so far, which is a rather wonderful memoir. Just only a few pages, actually, about her life in Lvov immediately after the war. She herself spent the war years in Tashkent, and immediately after the war, her family, her stepfather, brought her to Lvov, previously Lviv, which had itself just been brought from Poland into the Soviet Union. So there's a sort of double deport movement. And Lvov clearly very greatly enchanted Yekaterina Vasilievna as a young woman. I shall read just a few paragraphs from her memoir. and then starts asking her to talk more herself. Ukraine, the word Ukraine, in Russian at any rate, it means sort of on the edge. Lvov, my youth, a strange, fearsome, romantic town on the edge of the world. The four post-war years, the years of my youth, an amazing sensation of newness, as though I've been born into this world anew. The long journey from Tashkent has faded, receding into the mist with its heated goods wagons and passenger carriages, where a coupe is crammed with 30 people, where you sleep sitting up with your legs tucked under you, and where, if you linger in the loo, those waiting bang on the door with their fists and shout menacingly, "Hey, you in there!" We live in Hotel Europe and wonder at the frivolity of the Poles who have renamed room 13 12A. With the war over, everything associated with our evacuation remained in the east. But the centuries of wars had spared this old-fashioned town to the west, so out of the ordinary, so beautiful. The teeny streets of the centre with their medieval houses, each with three windows, had evidently seen a lot of trade. There's German Street, Turkish Street, Greek Street, all of them are tiny, just two, three or four houses. Merchants must have come to Lvov and taken up residence in three houses, each with three windows in the facade. How quaint they are, the unceremonious names of Lvov's streets, like Jan from Duclia Street, for instance. I never did find out where Duclia was, whether it was large or small, nor how its native son Jan made a name for himself. Then there is Under the Oak Street, another name which lets the imagination roam free. The Sovietists, busy renaming the streets, spare no effort as they try to uproot this free spirit. And moving from the hotel, we live on Democratic Street, better known to the locals as New World Street. Perplexed Polish ladies and gents eye the nameplates wanly. Standing not 2 feet from the Sapiega Street they have known since childhood, they timidly ask the incomers where Stalin Street is, then hurriedly correct themselves, Comrade Stalin Street. So that's just a little taster from this memoir, which has been translated by Carol Yermakova. I know that Yekaterina Vasilyevna is working at present on her memoir of her years in Tashkent, as I suppose in her early teens. So is there anything you would like to say about your work on the your memoir about Tashkent?
It is not yet finished. But I came to 1945, just before the end of the war. And it is very interesting this last year. People felt that the war goes to the end, and all wanted something beautiful. So went to theater, were very poor, but they красили, как сказать?
Красивый?
Красили краской. Из лекарств, из акрихина и стрептоцита марлевые платья. И все, по улицам ходили женщины в розовых и желтых платьях, окрашенных этим лекарством.
They used to, because there were no clothes, they used the colorings from the medicines. And just absolutely ordinary cloth was colored, was painted in this paint that they got from medication. And the whole city was full of women in pink and yellow dresses from the medication. patients.
И очень модны были платочки, обшитые широкой каймой кружев. Настолько модные, мы брали разные нитки, что устроили конкурс, и я заняла на нем первое место.
What was very fashionable were handkerchiefs with lots of decoration, and they were so fashionable that there was a competition who makes a better handkerchief, and Екатерина Васильевна won.
Так, и тогда мне сказали, что секретарь райкома, дама, просит, чтобы девочка, которая заняла первое место, сделала для нее платок. А наша руководительница, очень интеллигентная дама, сказала: Катя, имей в виду, у нее нет тонкого вкуса, сделай ей что-нибудь яркое и пестрое, а не такое, как ты делала для выставки.
The secretary of the party, of the Communist Party District Committee, asked for young Екатерина Васильевна to come to her and make a handkerchief for her, because she specifically said, the girl who won, I want her to come over and do the same for me. But because everybody knew that the taste of this party lady was really bad, she was told by her friends, don't do something subtle as you did for yourself, just do something really rough so that she would appreciate it.
It's just the episode when I stopped.
The place at which the memoir now ends. She's just written up to this place.
And I want to write about another side of the last months of war. It was very, we were happy, and we want this beauty in every aspect of life. But it was the months when were killed young men who were at the war all the 4 years, and were killed in at the same end, just my first cousin. And it is это большое горе, это большой удар. Это вот.
That was very painful, of course, because that was at the very last.
Это вторая сторона. Эти погибшие в самом конце войны, которые провоевали 4 года.
That is the second side, so to speak, to these last days of war. The people who died in the very, very end, after having gone through 4 years of fighting.
Is there anything which you, when you've been thinking about these years recently, is there anything that was a surprise to you? Anything new that you thought for the first time?
Когда вы сейчас это вспоминали, было ли что-то новое, что вдруг вы вспомнили, что-то
сейчас
открылось ли вам что-то в тех воспоминаниях, чего как-то вы, может, забыли, или что-то вас сейчас наново удивило?
Было, но я сейчас как-то... Я даже помнила, что что-то такое было, что я увидела заново, но в этот момент я не могу вспомнить. Наверное, я просто волнуюсь.
I'm sure I had these feelings of these sudden discoveries of something that I'd forgotten, but nothing occurs to me at the moment. I might be just slightly nervous.
Может быть, я вспомню позже.
Maybe it will come back to me.
I've also had the privilege during the last few months, while working on the collection of Grossman's stories and a few articles, which is going to be published in the autumn, called The Road. It's got quite a lot of introductory sections and notes that I've been writing myself, but I've been kind of running all these by Екатерина Васильевна. Email has been a great blessing in that respect. So she's been filling me in with, you know, a number of little stories of events in Grossman's life. But what I haven't really asked her about Екатерина is Grossman's only child, but she's the daughter by his first wife, so she didn't actually see a lot of him as a child. She got to know him more as an adult. What I haven't really asked her about is her sort of her first readings of Grossman's work. So when did you first read? What did you first read of your father's?
Что мы первое, что вы прочитали первым? Степан Кольчугин. It was a novel, very popular in Russia. It is a very warm and vivid book, and characters beautifully written. And some quality in this book. When you read it, though it shows very poor life, but you wish to live there in this, to live in this book. It is very cordial.
This is a novel written in the 1930s.
All the Russia read it, and simple people and writers and scientists and пограничник, как это?
Border patrol men.
Very many letters, such. Папка такая.
Yeah, there were packs of letters that he received.
It's a novel set mostly before the revolution, in a kind of mining community in Ukraine, and it was the first of. It was nominated for a Stalin Prize in the late 30s, but vetoed, probably by Stalin. Did you in the 1930s? Did you read his early stories as well? When at the same time?
In my childhood.
Yes.
No. Stories were later.
Do you remember reading in the town of Berdichev?
In Berdichev, yes. Berdichev, and about happiness, several stories are with this title.
Mm-hmm.
A story about happiness, just happiness, and еще какая-то третья была.
Yes. So these are all short stories written in the 1930s.
And one early story by my father was, as every young writer does, he wrote about ancient Rome. And when I was a girl, I liked this story.
I, for many years, imagined I'd sort of completed a job by translating this quite lengthy book. And I don't know whether it was a sort of, to what extent it was just a laziness in being ready to accept received opinion, or whether it was a laziness about not wanting to think that there was another great book that needed to be translated. But it's only very recently dawned on me that, I had always understood that this is the second book in what could be called a dilogy. There is a previous novel, much of which is also set in Stalingrad, called For a Just Cause. For a Just Cause was published in the early 50s, actually with huge difficulty. The amount of dramas over the publication is just unimaginable, and the kind of doggedness that Grossman showed. It was actually
set up in type three times, and each time at the last minute there was an order to break up the type, not to publish. Finally, it was published. And the kind of lazy received opinion for a long time, which I'm ashamed to say that I repeated, is that it was a kind of, that it is a greatly inferior novel to Life and Fate. In actual fact, having now read it, I would say that there are many chapters that are really indistinguishable from Life and Fate, many chapters about the Shaposhnikov sisters, which are as witty and graceful and charming and fun as in Life and Fate. There are chapters set in Stalingrad, of the fighting in Stalingrad, which are every bit as vivid and moving as in Life and Fate. There just aren't the very, very bold, uncompromising political reflections. But what there is very, very fine. So after that introduction, when did you first read Za pravaya dyelo? Did you read it before it was published?
There was one publication, and there was good press on it, mm-hmm. and then appeared this article by Bubinov,
very negative article.
And then began this campaign against. But for some time, this book was edited first time, and I read it there. I knew this book. It's его первое издание.
Yeah, she read the first publication, the first edition of the novel.
And what was your impression of it then, 50 years ago?
Of this book?
Yes.
There are very strong scenes, very strong chapters in this book. The meeting of Berezkin, of this Soviet officer, very Russian, very... very simple and kind. Вот я хочу, чтобы вы лучше перевели. Да. Мне кажется, что Березкиным отец превзошел Платона Каратаева, потому что Платон Каратаев все-таки как-то не вызывает таких чувств. А Березкин живой и не ущербный, не обреченный.
I would like to compare this character, Berezkin, with Tolstoy's character, Platon Karataev. I actually think that probably my father has put something of Platon Karataev into this character, but he is even more charming because he's not doomed, and he doesn't suffer from all sorts of previous hardships, but he is just a very charming, simple, nice man.
Nice, simple man. And it is, I think that it's not, это не случайно.
And it is not accidental?
Not accidental. Berezkin is at the beginning of Za pravaya dyelo, and Berezkin is dedicated the very last chapter of Life and Doom.
Life and Fate.
Life and Fate.
It is, it's inevitable, really, that we tend to oversimplify when we are making connections between a writer's work and their lives, and there are obviously a lot of similarities between Grossman himself and Victor Strum in the two long novels. But Grossman clearly has given a few of his life experiences to Berezkin, whom we are talking about, and certainly
some very important experiences, like having a mortar shell land between one's feet and not explode. This is something that happened to both Beryozkin and to Grossman. We think of Grossman's, in many respects, a tragic figure, but he was certainly at some times in the war, he was known as a lucky Grossman, that he did, like Beryozkin, escape death several times.
Я все-таки думаю, что они люди очень разного типа, и что здесь я с вами не соглашусь.
I can't quite agree with you about the comparison between Grossman and Beryozkin. I think they are really people of very, very different characters.
I agree that they're different characters, but a few life experiences
Вот тут есть какая-то правда, потому что отец когда-то мне сказал, что у него было много тяжелого в жизни. Тем не менее, он сказал, что ему не близок и не нравится образ писателя-страдальца. Он, в общем, был писатель-боец, а не страдалец.
My father once said to me that although he has had quite a lot of hardship in his life, he doesn't like the image of a suffering writer. He didn't treat himself, didn't see himself as a sufferer. He rather thought of himself as of a fighter.
I'm very, very glad to hear that, because I certainly agree. And it leads me into wanting to talk about his last years. And I myself have a feeling that I, and other readers as well, constantly feel a bit behind with Grossman. I feel I'm taking a very long time always to appreciate particular sides of Grossman, that I keep realizing after many years that I'd underestimated some work or some side of Grossman. And this work, Everything Flows, which he did one version of in the 50s and then revised in the last few years of his life. Reviewers are often seeing it as a kind of rather dark work. I am myself struck by there's an intelligence, especially in the chapters about Russian history, there's a kind of liveliness and an intelligence which I find very, very inspiriting. And I'm also struck by the fact that it's often seen as kind of polemical, that Grossman is having a polemic with Lenin and Stalin and so on. But it's actually my editor in New York who first said this, that he sees Lenin in this book as a tragic figure, that Grossman is in a way kind of not arguing with Lenin, but sort of entering into him and identifying with him and seeing him as a tragic figure. And I think
you ask a question first.
Yes. Shall I just read a page about Lenin?
Ленин,
This is obviously historically this is entirely correct, but it is also in a way a kind of poetry. So Grossman sees Russia in 1917. As a girl who has been released from slavery, and she has to make her choice between the different kind of teachings, the different political teachings on offer, and Russia chooses Lenin. She followed him because he promised her mountains of gold and rivers flowing with wine. Willingly at first, trustfully, she followed him along a merry, intoxicating path lit by the burning estates of landowners. Then she began to stumble, to look back, ever more terrified of the path now stretching before her. But the grip of the iron hand that led her was growing tighter and tighter. And he, imbued with apostolic faith, walked on, leading Russia behind him, failing to realize that he had succumbed to a strange delusion. In Russia's obedient walk, in her renewed submissiveness, everything he had brought from the freedom-loving West was being transformed. Everything he had brought to Russia was drowning and perishing. He thought that his unshakable dictatorial power guaranteed that the ideal he believed in, the gift he had brought to his country, would be preserved in all its purity. He rejoiced in this power. He identified it with the justice of his faith. And then, for one terrible moment, he realized that his unyielding strength as the leader of a country so gentle, a country so submissive and easily influenced, was really a supreme form of impotence. And the tighter his grip, the sterner his stride, the more obedient Russia became to his educated and revolutionary violence, the less power Lenin possessed to struggle against the truly satanic force of Russia's serf past.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
To me, this seems like very, very intelligent and very sophisticated historical writing. My feeling is that Grossman's sophistication hasn't really been appreciated yet. Do you agree?
With the history of Russia?
Мне кажется, что недооценивают тонкость его мысли.
По поводу арабской натуры
русского человека? По поводу Ленина и Сталина.
По поводу Ленина и Сталина? I think that the chapter about Lenin was...
too soft?
Was rather soft, yes. He was from a family of revolutionary. My granddad was in the party, and he before First World War, he worked with some circles and agitated and agitated. Как сказать?
Propaganda.
He was propaganda.
Yes, and my father has some такой вот в лице своего отца он имел такой пример романтичного и героического человека. И таким он видел революционера.
His father, for him, he saw his father as a romantic, revolutionary young man, and that was his idea of a revolution.
Поэтому особенно была ему революция, представлялась желанной. И вот эти несколько месяцев между февральской и октябрьской революцией замечательным временем.
That's why he welcomed the revolution in February 1917, and these months between February and October seemed an absolutely wonderful time for him.
А это было на самом деле очень сложное время и очень опасное для России.
But in fact, this time was quite complex and quite dangerous for Russia.
Так, с протестами, что делать? Давайте вспомните.
I want to move on to. I was very pleased to see in the interview that Екатерина Васильевна did recently for the New Statesman, that she said that she named two particular works of Grossman's as her favorites. One is a short story called In the Big Ring, but the one I want to talk about is it's a work of about 100 pages. It's hard to describe it. It's called Good Wishes, I think is how it should be translated. But the title has been translated as Peace Be With You. It's an account of 2 months that he spent in Armenia in late 1961. And I only read it for the first time recently and was absolutely enchanted by it. And decided at once that was the next thing that I would like to translate. So I was very pleased when I discovered that it was one of your two favorite works. Do you want to say a little more about why you like it so much? Dobro vam, yeah.
Yes, it's... мудрая, добрая, светлая.
It's a very wise, kind, and light book.
Это не получится совсем легкая книга.
Well, it is full of light.
It's Grossman's most personal work, probably. He says more about himself than in any other work.
But even the Everything Flows, which is a collection of all negative what was in our country, when I worked with Robert's translation, at the end of the book, I suddenly noticed one passage which shows that my father was more optimistic in aspect of human nature than many people now in Russia. He believed that men can стать лучше,
improve,
yes, and that is it is in our power.
We have the strength, the possibility to get better.
And another thing that there is no such wicked
person
who is only wicked. Every has in his life, in his biography, in his actions, something when
something good.
Some sort of ray of hope, some ray of goodness in him.
I think it might be. There are many other things we could say or read, but I think it. Since Ekaterina Vasilievna doesn't. This is her first trip to England. I hope she'll come again, but I think we should probably best to use the opportunity as much as possible for questions. So please ask her whatever questions you would like.
I would like to say something else.
Дело в том, что вот насчет рабского характера России наши великие классики, or our great classic literature was situated in the center of Russia, and these areas were most крепостническими.
Сейчас я переведу, потом вы скажете
по-русски.
The thing is, what I wanted to talk about a bit is about the slavish nature of Russia, because this episode with Lenin, it talks about Russia as formally being enslaved. Our great literature originated in the center of Russia, in the areas which where people were for a very long time under serfdom, where people were serfs.
И были огромные области, где жили вольные крестьяне, вольные казаки. Это огромные области России. Я сама из материнской семьи казаков, где гордились вольностью и тем, что никогда не были рабами.
But in Russia there were other areas, and some of the areas were populated by free peasants, or for example Cossacks. On my mother's line, I come from a family of Cossacks, and I know that they have always been proud of being of always being free.
In Garrison's War Diaries, he mentions quite often the book that he wrote. I think it was done Dickens-like in a series printed by the Army magazine. And I think it was called The People's Army. And according to...
Sorry, he mentions a book called...
Well, I'm trying to think of the name. I've just finished the book. But I think it's called The People's Army. He wrote a book... Well, it's People Immortal. And apparently it was one of the most popular books ever written during the war, with the stories of the ordinary soldier from the front. And I wondered if that book still exists, or if it's published in Russia, or if it has any standing today.
It's not much read today. I mean, it was the first Soviet war novel. It was actually translated into English during the war itself. It's very easy to get an English translation second-hand on the internet. Quite a bit of Grossman was translated at that time. It was the first Soviet war novel. It's got some very, very vivid passages in it. In comparison with what he wrote later, it does now seem propagandist. But there are images, kind of paragraphs, that are wonderful.
Thanks.
But just go on the internet and look for it.
I've got a number of questions, and I have to select just one, if I may, or perhaps two. Your father must have been very famous during the war because of his war journalism. How long was he able to work successfully after the war, even for a few years, as a journalist, or did Stalin prevent it? That's really my first question. Was he able to work and make a living in the late 40s as a well-known journalist? And the second question is, from Life and Fate, we learn that at least the characters, and probably Vasily Grossman himself, realised that Stalin had become anti-Semitic during the war. How did this affect Vasily Grossman's own political views in the 40s, and how did it develop? How did they develop?
Мне или вам?
Я не очень поняла вопрос, честно говоря.
Я сначала отвечу, и потом вы.
Immediately after the war, I don't think he had any particular wish to work as a journalist. He had two main projects. One was writing for a just cause, and he was still hoping, at least in 1945-46, to publish the Black Book, and this documentary account that he and Ehrenburg had compiled about Nazi massacres in the Western Soviet Union and the death camps. This was meeting increasing opposition, and I don't think it was actually till, I forget, 1947 that it was completely and absolutely vetoed. But it's terribly hard to imagine how deeply that must have affected Grossman, because it's years that he had devoted himself to this project of huge personal importance. His own mother had been shot, and he appears just to have heard that the book wasn't going to be published and just carried on working on for a just cause. But let me see if Ekaterina Vasilievna has anything more to add. То, что когда запретили черную книгу, когда окончательно сказали...
Ты не в курсе этих дел, вот именно насчет черной книги.
Вы не в курсе.
Я не в курсе.
Ну, можно ответить на первый
вопрос. Казачье отродье такое, не особенно болеющее еврейским вопросом, не так сильно, как... что, безусловно, мог жить на свой заработок и иметь один из первых телевизоров в Москве. Это вот эти послевоенные годы. Его очень много издавали.
At first, in the first years after the war, when his fame was still big, he could even live on income he got as a journalist, and they had one of the first television sets and lots of other writers came to him to watch his television, because that was a sign of affluence, obviously. But that was for a short period only. And as far as the Black Book is concerned, I can't tell very much about it.
Там всё менялось. После статьи Бубинова были тяжёлые годы, и его не печатали. Потом, да, Сталин умер. И выступление Фадеева в защиту этой книги.
The situation actually was changing. First of all, there was this very condemning article by Bubinov, and these years immediately following it were quite difficult. He couldn't publish any of his writings. Then Stalin died, and there was an article of a speech of Fadeev, who was head of the Union of the Soviet Writers, actually supporting the book. So it became a little bit easier.
Да, и на 50-летие он получил орден, один из таких Второй по значению был в России.
When he was when he turned 50, which was 1955, he received quite an important order, quite an important medal, the second in the rank of the Soviet awards. It was quite prestigious.
А потом вот это, когда он уже показал жизнь и судьбу, и тогда начинается уже действительно долгий и тяжелый период его жизни, в частности,
финансовый. But about when, of course, he started showing the life and fate. This really was the beginning of a very difficult period of his life, and also financially as well.
He wasn't condemned as a Jewish cosmopolitan or Zionist or anything like that.
Его лично не обвиняли в том, что
in late 1952, the campaign against him, which Екатерина Васильевна was just mentioning, the article by Bubionov, that was very, very much linked with the anti-Jewish campaign, yes. And if Stalin, you know, the denunciatory articles about against Grossman were reaching a crescendo just before Stalin's death. So, yes.
I lived in Donbass just during this campaign against my father. And I have disputes with my
the people where we were living, the landlords,
and in school too, some teachers told me, your father is
a coward.
A coward. She has no bravery to come and to say that he is not right. And I answered always very certainly.
Quite with lots of anger.
If he was a coward, he давно бы покаялся.
And I it was suggested that he should admit his faults. And he must be a coward because he was not doing it. And Екатерина Васильевна said to the person who suggested it, she said, if he had been, if he were a coward, he would go and repent. The fact that he's not doing it means the opposite.
And they, so was it me, some of my of our teachers, that at last я в конце концов надоело с ними спорить, я стала каждый день дежурить по школе, ходила, смотрела по классам, чтобы не сидеть в учительской и не слушать глупых разговоров.
So these arguments in the school where she was working were really getting on her nerves at some point, and she stopped going into the teacher's room where all these discussions were happening every day, and she volunteered to be a teacher on duty so that she could go in the building of the school, but not to be with the other teachers.
And my pupils were glad because as a teacher I was rather popular. I liked teaching with play, сыгрываем моментом, with plays, with some.
Английский преподаватель.
Да, да.
So she was teaching English using all sorts of games, and that's why her pupils liked her.
Я еще из особенно способных, которым было иногда скучно, я организовала кружок перевода, и он у меня работал несколько месяцев, пока я там была.
And there were some children who were interested in English, and they formed the basis of a small society of translation from English, and it worked quite well for several years.
What did they translate?
Что они переводили?
Adapted stories about Ослененке, Kipling.
Oh, right. Well, Kipling's just so stories about the elephant that was adapted, and that was the school and translation society was visited with.
Such stories, they were at the end of the textbook.
Everything Flows could hardly be more different from Life and Fate as a book. I think it is a wonderful book. I've heard it described as not so much a novel as a series of meditations on the revolution. Could you comment on that?
Yes, we both should, probably. I've been thinking quite a lot about this recently, and I think it's another case where I was a bit lazy and underestimated Grossman. That he clearly could have, if he'd just wanted to write an essay on Russian history, he could have perfectly well have written an essay on Russian history and just called it that and not made it a part of a novel. He chose to insert it into a novel which was already complete. The novel already in the early 50s, in the mid-50s version, had the beginning and end that it now has, the later material he inserted into the middle of it. He chose to do that. I think we underestimate what a kind of an unusual, rather modernist novel it is. And there are some very kind of delicate little hinge moments in the book. There's a wonderful passage where Ivan Grigorievich, who's come back from the camps, is making friends with a young nephew of his landlady. And the little boy asks him to test, he wants Ivan Grigorievich to test him for his history exam. And, you know, Grossman chooses, it could have been biology, it could have been anything, but it's history. And that is one of the little hinges that leads into the first of the historical chapters. The whole basic structure of the novel, the kind of, the contrast between the failed meeting of the two cousins, the cousin who's come back from the camps and the cousin who has had a successful life as a scientist. And they both have high hopes of their meeting, but the cousin who's been successful actually ends up, instead of sort of repenting and confessing as he vaguely intends, he ends up sort of endlessly justifying himself to Ivan, who is back from the camps, justifying himself in terribly complex language and sort of shifting. That conversation is kind of perfectly balanced by the absolutely crystalline, clear account by the landlady, who was in a small way involved as a local official in the terror famine, and she tells her story of her past as a kind of a real gift. It's a terrible story, but she says it with absolute clarity, and it's actually at the beginning of the kind of love relationship between her and Ivan. So these two conversations balance each other perfectly. I think the structure of the novel is much more sophisticated than I first took in until I'd read it several times. I've talked a long time.
Я думаю, что это не роман в полном смысле слова, в нем очень много элементов публицистики.
I don't think it is a novel in the full sense of the word. There's lots of journalism in it.
Там собраны все эти негативные темы, ГУЛАГ, космополитизм, голод на Украине, все.
There are very many Ленин, critical themes there. The ГУЛАГ, the famine in the Ukraine, the campaign of cosmopolitan campaign, Lenin, Stalin, it's all there.
Но там есть великолепные главы, которые являются романными. Это встреча двух двоюродных братьев.
But there are, of course, magnificent chapters there which are novelistic in themselves. This meeting of the cousins.
И совершенно потрясающе то, что я считаю самым сильным написанным отцом, это рассказ о голоде на Украине и последняя крохотная главка о том, как достойные любящие люди, жертвуя друг для друга, умирали и помогали и любили друг друга.
But and also what I think is among the best pages written by my father. Not among the best, but it really is the very best the strongest writing written by my father. The description of the famine in Ukraine and the description in the very end, a short chapter describing decent people sacrificing everything for each other for the sake of love to each other.
It's вершина саммит,
the epitome. The вершина чего?
Творчество, я думаю, это маленькая главка.
This small chapter about this human sacrifices and love is the summit, the epitome of Grossman's writing for me.
We've included in this volume an afterword that Ekaterina Vasilievna wrote, where she tells the story of how that one journal published the long chapter about the famine and didn't tell her until the editor didn't tell her until it was already a fait accompli that he had left out the following much, much shorter chapter, a very moving, very sweet chapter about this very loving couple, which is the chapter that Ekaterina Vasilievna especially admires, but this editor just kind of casually left it out because probably was more attracted by the harsher tone of the previous chapter.
So I was an unlucky publisher.
I'd like to ask Ekaterina, please, about her life in and work in Lvov in the post-war years. I'd like to know why the family moved to Lvov and the political situation that she found there between the Russians, the Ukrainian and Polish populations, given that the Jews had been deported to the camps and the Poles had been deported east back into the Polish borders, and the kind of work that she and Vasily Grossman was involved in there, please. Thank you.
Если бы прочли этот очерк, you understand Russian?
No.
Yeah. If you read this
essay,
all you ask is there. We went to Lvov because my mother's second husband left his mother in Kyiv, and she saved Jews and partisans, and she was hanged by German. And he can't come to the city where his mother perished. Понятно говорю, да? So we went to Lvov. And his director, which was in Tashkent, worked in Lvov and proposed him to be his
That was the work relations of
the director института туда пошел.
He became the deputy of the director of the institute, and that's why they moved to Lvov. That was the second husband of her mother.
The national relations. Local people do not like Russian especially таких бесцеремонных.
The people in Lvov, the local people, didn't like the rudeness of the Russians, especially.
And very typical Russian. But we were Ukraine. We, my mother and me, we spoke Ukrainian fluently. And attention to us was very warm. And there were many people, young people, who told to me, we will save you. They, I don't know quite, but they thought, it seems to me, that some army came to Lvov, and Lvov would not be Soviet, and then they saved me.
So they were ready to save her if some army invades.
Мне было очень приятно, что меня хотят спасти, но я не очень верила, что кто-нибудь захватит.
I was very pleased that there were people wanting to save me, but I didn't believe that anybody was going to occupy Lvov.
I have a very great girlfriend who was Polish. And we studied in one group at the university, at Lvov University. I know the story. I did not know that man, but I know the story about a young Jew student who wrote to his girlfriend a letter when he reproached her that she
was friends with
Russian and the Ukrainian, and this young man disappeared from university. I think he was arrested.
Could I ask about the eventual publication? And how it's received.
Как в России воспринимают публикацию, как в России восприняли жизнь и судьбу, когда ее напечатали?
В 88-м в начале мы печатали в первый.
1988 was the date of publication of Flag and Fate in a magazine. In a magazine, in thick magazine.
But I saw in the library some people who came and asked, give me this book, and then with... С таким лицом, как будто, ну вот, нехорошо, но надо, дайте в Гроссмана.
А почему нехорошо, но надо?
Они противники были.
She actually even saw people in the library who wanted to get the book, although their faces were saying that they were not really future admirers, but they felt that this was a must read, that they have to read this book, and that was, they had to queue in the library to get it. They were saying, okay, let me have Grossman as well, because now everybody's reading it, I have to do it too.
When I went in the street, in taxi, with these books or with this magazine, everybody asked me, give me one book.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.